Welcome to Beauty 4.0, Decoding the Business of Beauty, a podcast by Cosmetic Design. We take you inside for a close-up of the innovations and innovators behind the beauty and personal care industry and find out just how they are shaping its future. On this episode, I am joined by my friend and colleague, the brilliant Cassandra Stern, editor of CosmeticsDesign.com, to discuss the opportunities for Asian beauty brands in the US. We discuss the moves, the trends, and talk some mocha updates. All that and more insight on Beauty 4.0. So I guess I should start by setting up the context of our chat today. And if you look at the business and finance articles and commentary we've published over the last year or so, the Chinese beauty market has not bounced back the way people expected. And because of this, the term we've been hearing a lot lately in regards to China is diversification, as in diversifying away from the market. Companies are deciding that it may not be a good idea to put all their eggs into one basket. You know, Indian retailer Nykaa has even actually come up to say that it was expecting brands to pay more attention to India as they, quote, diversify and de-risk from China. And in particular, the South Korean beauty companies have been shifting their gaze westward towards North America. And we've had, you know, LGH and H acquire an American hair care brand, Arctic Fox, a couple of years ago. And both it and Amore Pacific, as another fellow beauty giant, have highlighted the importance of a North American expansion. In fact, Cassandra, you've had a chat with Amore Pacific recently about their interest in the US.
Yeah, actually, it was a really wonderful chat, and thank you for bringing that up, Amanda, because that was a very fun interview that we did and posted relatively recently on the Cosmetics Design US site. So in the US, I would say that Amore Pacific is probably best known for Laneige. Recently, I would say within the last 12 months or so, went viral on social media for their lip mask. In that interview, we talked a lot about the steps that Amore Pacific is taking to expand in the U.S. I think that their biggest influence and their biggest focus is customized cosmetics, which is also a huge trend, I think, not only sweeping the U.S. market, but I think also internationally. And so what Amore Pacific is really focusing on doing is marrying customized cosmetics and technology to diversify their product offerings. Specifically in retailers like Sephora and Bloomingdale's, Amore Pacific is looking to launch a couple different things. One is recently at the Consumer Electronics Show, their Authentic Color Master by Tonework Technology won an innovation award. And basically what that technology does is it uses AI algorithms for facial color measurement, and then it uses a mechanized robotic arm to craft a personalized foundation, lip product that's going to be a perfect match for that individual consumer. I think that's something that's super exciting for a lot of consumers. I mean, you always hear complaints, right, about how, you know, color matching is so difficult. You've got to go into the store. You can't quite get a good match. The Tonework technology, according to the interview, actually provides a spectrum of 150 different shades, which includes 30 different levels of brightness and 5 different undertones, which is something that is completely unheard of in today's cosmetic space. No one's really been able to replicate those types of results. And this technology really delivers the ability to, again, cater to all of their particular unique users. Everyone's different, and their unique shades. It also offers a couple other options, different finishes, glow versus semi-matte, different forms, foundation versus like a cushion, kind of more like a BB cream. If you put all of that together, you're looking at over 600 different types of personalized base makeup options. And all of those are optimized for the individual's specific skin color, which again is super duper exciting. And the other type of technology that they were offering is the launch of Custom.me. Custom.me is a tailored one-to-one life beauty brand. It was launched in February of this year. And what it offers as a brand is a personalized, again, talking to that customized, personalized beauty experience. And it's a mobile skin analysis service. So we've got dedicated one-to-one manager services, ultra-personalized custom products, the convenience of being able to access it anytime, anywhere, using a smartphone, which we all have in our pockets these days. In February of this year, Amore Pacific debuted the Bespoke Essence, which is a product that was designed to offer an even more sophisticated custom beauty experience, in the words of the interviewee. This actually offers, and this number totally astonished me, but this actually offers nearly 18,400 different combinations based on a different individual skin concern, preference, and lifestyle data that's put into the app, and delivers a product that is custom fit to you. And again, we're talking about unprecedented levels, right, of customization. We're talking about something that you can't just walk into a store and buy this off a shelf. This is made for you. So I think that people are going to be really excited to see this level of personalization. I mean, we've seen this in supplements, beauty-related supplements. We've seen this in a variety of different product spaces in the cosmetics kind of industry. But to see this level of customization in cosmetics and products specifically is, I think, something that really fits very neatly into that niche of diversification that you're talking about.
That's really interesting to hear. Like, it seems like they're kind of positioning themselves as the personalization expert for America. Is that
yeah,
fair to say?
I could totally agree with that assessment. You know, I think that they not only want to establish themselves as an authority, but they also want to back it up, right, with that plethora of options and the precision of the technology to be able to kind of, again, you know, walk the walk and talk the talk. I think it's going to be really intriguing to see not only how this launch is received, because again, we're talking something pretty new. This was just done earlier this year. You know, you really got to give it a good year or so before you really can get some of those numbers and some of that data. But I think that, you know, going forward, it's going to be really intriguing to see the adoption rate of the app, the custom.me app, and also to see the success in actual in-store retailers. Again, this is in Sephora and Bloomingdale's. So we're talking about some, you know, some well-respected, well-known retailers here in the U.S. So I'll be very excited to see adoption rates and numbers in the coming months.
Well, it sounds like, from what you're saying, that they're really making a huge effort for the US market. But it's not just them. We also have brands like Clear Cosmetics, which is a smaller but very popular K-beauty brand in my neck of the woods. And it recently debuted on Target.com. And Misha, which is one of the quote-unquote first-generation K-beauty brands, recently signed on Elizabeth Olsen, an American celebrity, as a brand ambassador. And I think the intentions couldn't get clearer than that.
I totally agree. And you actually kind of make me think of an interesting question for you, Amanda. So, you know, when we started, you mentioned kind of this lull in the Chinese market. Do you think that this lull is temporary?
Well, I can't say for sure, but I can tell you that speaking to the Chinese locals, that there isn't as much excitement for K-beauty or even K-pop and K-culture in China anymore. You know, they don't even seem interested in traveling to Korea anymore, which I think is evident by how the Korean travel retail market has been performing. And I've actually asked a few locals about the beauty brands that excite them, and they all mentioned their own local brands. One of them that was mentioned was Color Key. I think there was a lot of enthusiasm for this brand, and that was for makeup. And when I asked them for skincare, you know, what skincare brands that excite them, it's pretty clear that they loved Japanese brands for their reputation in R&D and quality. And they were really excited about Western brands as well, especially the ultra-luxurious ones like La Mer, La Prairie, and Helena Rubinstein. So it's a pretty competitive space. And in light of all this movement, Cass, could you give us some perspective from the other side? You know, what are the consumers' perception of Asian brands? What do they associate with Japanese brands, Korean brands, that sort of thing?
That's a great question, Amanda, and I would love to speak on that a little bit further. You know, I was actually recently reading a really interesting article that was put out by Nielsen IQ. They're a market research data firm. And they took a particular look at what Asian American Pacific Islander, AAPI, owned facial skincare brands have seen in the U.S. You know, and that particular niche category in beauty and skincare has actually seen more success in the general market over the past year. Those with larger in-store presences like Shiseido, actually, I mean, are probably one of the best known and best respected brands in the U.S. But the article also took a look at the actual AAPI consumer fan base. Facial skincare brands that are Korean owned or Asian Pacific Islander owned really appeal to this consumer fan base. We're talking about 22 million consumers, beauty care consumers in the U.S. That's 7%, which may not sound super high, but they definitely have very considerable buying power. This particular group of consumer in the U.S. drives sales with a very high, consistent buy rate. This remains true for Shiseido and Tatcha skincare. AAPI consumers actually make up more than half of all sales for those particular brands in the U.S. And I think that it's really interesting to look both particularly in that specific demographic of consumer, as well as taking a wider scale view. I think another place to look when we're talking about U.S. consumer perception of Asian brands would be to actually turn to social media and look at really popular influencers in this space and the impact that they're having on consumer buyer habits, right? So we've got a couple. The article mentioned a few. One in particular is Sarah Chung, who is the founder of Sachu. She's a key facial tool influencer. And the article that I was reading was talking about how she has a very strong YouTube following. She, in particular, refers back to the Gua Sha tool, the facial massage and sculpting tool that she uses in her videos, and she shows different techniques for how to use them for impactful results. And that actually comes directly from her, her native history, coming from Hong Kong. Another influencer that was mentioned in the article that I think is worth talking about here is Patrick Ta. He's a member of the LGBTQIA plus community, and he created an entire makeup line, a self-titled beauty brand, actually, Patrick Ta, which is carried at Sephora. The whole purpose behind his brand was that he, you know, he really struggled with self-confidence. I think that's something that a lot of consumers, regardless of where you are, can really relate to, right? And, you know, his whole goal was to help men and women feel more confident in their skin. These two particular influencers have had a huge impact on growing, I think, the K-Beauty Asian Pacific Islander brand space in the U.S. And so the second part of your question, talking about what do U.S. consumers associate with Japanese brands, Korean brands, I think and this is just my opinion, but I think the first thing that comes to mind as a U.S. consumer is quality. I think that there is certainly a perception that there are certain ingredients that Japanese brands, K-brands, use that are maybe not as well known in the U.S., not because they're not as effective, but just because they're not as common. And I think a lot of U.S. consumers who are frustrated with mainstream ingredients will turn to these types of brands to see what other types of product offerings are out there. In particular, I would say if we're looking at a specific category, one of the most common would be sun care, actually. There is a huge, huge following on social media for K-brand sunscreens, Japanese brand sunscreens. You know, watery essences, you know, things are just formulated sometimes a little bit differently than your typical mainstream American manufactured product. And I think that the perception overall is generally very positive. You know, I follow a lot of beauty blogs and a lot of forums that talk about these types of products on my own time, just to kind of stay abreast with trends in this area. And I think one of the overwhelming pieces of commentary that I kind of take away is that unless you're somewhere that is extremely hot, and we're talking like Death Valley hot, that these products in general are going to be a little bit more effective, particularly under makeup. They definitely lend themselves, because of the formulations, they're a little bit thinner, a little bit lighter, they mix a little bit better overall with the complexion. You know, you always hear about the white cast, right? You always hear about, my face is too pale, this doesn't mix with my makeup. Generally, the takeaway that I see is that those aren't really issues with these types of brands. So if you're looking for something from a consumer perspective that mixes well with makeup, these are the types of brands you want to look for.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree on the sun care one. Like, I am so confident in the Asian sunscreens that I know if I walk into a drugstore, if I close my eyes and pick one, I will be protected from the sun and it will work fantastically.
Mm-hmm. Totally, absolutely. I completely agree.
So how will you rate the potential of Asian brands in the US, because it is a very, very competitive space as well, not forgetting that?
You know, that's a fantastic question, Amanda. And I think for this, I'm going to kind of pull back to my friends over at Nielsen IQ again with some data, if you don't mind, because I am a very data-centric girl. I like to be supported by the numbers. So my friends over at Nielsen IQ recently released a quarter one for 2023 beauty and personal care overview, just tracking the impact on retail growth. When you speak about competitiveness in the market, I think it's important to remember that at least for right now, we're seeing growth across a lot of different areas. So while it's competitive, there's room for a lot of different brands to stretch their legs and really enter this space. In particular, you know, if we're talking about some really quick key takeaways, in quarter one, we're seeing lifts in both in-store and online shopping in the beauty and personal care space. Nielsen IQ is actually quoting that at 9%. Online sales are growing by 16%, which are outpacing in-store gains. We're looking also seeing that there's been a lot of category expansion in sales growth, mostly supported by online sales, but in particular, fragrances, cosmetics, nails, and deodorant continue to post really strong growth in the beginning of this year, which seems to be flowing into this summer. In the U.S., we are experiencing a little bit of inflation. Layoffs are kind of, you know, on people's mind. Dollar sales, however, are continuing to grow, according to this report, and outpacing unit sales. So when we talk about competitiveness, yes, it's competitive, but the numbers don't lie. And the numbers really speak to there being enough room for everything from independent to drugstore manufactured products to continue to fly off shelves. You know, in particular, we're seeing gains in things like body sprays, face cosmetics, lip cosmetics are seeing huge growth, body lotions and body treatments. Where we're really seeing declines are in areas where I don't know if Asian beauty brands really have a huge impact anyway. Things like nail appliances, electric razors, hand sanitizers took a really big dip. But when you think of K-beauty brands or Japanese beauty brands in the U.S., you're not necessarily thinking of hand sanitizer, right? So that's kind of how I would answer that. That's kind of what I would say. I would say that, yeah, it's a competitive market, but as long as we're continuing to see strong trending growth, I think that there is room for a variety of different brands to penetrate the market and kind of stake their claim with the US consumer.
Fantastic. Well, if one were to look for Asian brands in the US, you know, where would they go? Are there any specialty stores?
There are specialty stores. There are a lot of really cool Asian focused markets. A lot of them are very food centric, but they do offer a cosmetic space. I really think that if you're a consumer in the U.S. and you're particularly looking for like a Tatcha skincare, the best place to really go would be like a Sephora, like an Ulta, a major brand that's focused on delivering cosmetics and personal beauty care products. You may not find as many of these offerings on a drugstore shelf, but a specialized makeup or cosmetic store would be very likely to carry a lot of these brands.
So what are the major beauty trends in the US right now? Now, what are the consumers looking for in their brands and products?
Now, that's something that we write a lot about on Cosmetics Design US. We're always talking about trends. Most recently, I was at Cosmoprof in North America, the conference in Las Vegas. I was there last month. I saw a lot of things when I was there. I had a couple key takeaways, and then there were also some trend spotters and some market research firms that had their own takeaways. In particular, some of the things that I noticed when I was walking the show floor were kind of fun. One of them was marine ingredients. Marine ingredients are not new, right? We're not talking about somebody who's reinvented the wheel. This isn't something that's never been done before, but there's definitely a resurgence of marine ingredients in cosmetic and personal care products. Things like sea salt, things like just ocean-inspired ingredients are really making a comeback right now. There was one brand in particular that caught my eye that was called Laguna Sands, and they had a complete ocean-inspired collection, right? So they had algae ingredients, they had sea salt ingredients, and they were really kind of trying to just hit all of those points. So that would definitely be a trend that I'm seeing. You're also seeing it as well in things like product names, even. If you talk about like OPI nail polish, super well known, you're kind of seeing that even in the names of the colors right now. So definitely marine ingredients and marine inspired kind of color palettes, blues and all of those kind of gorgeous, rich colors. We're seeing that a little bit in cosmetics as well. Another trend that really caught my eye, which really appealed to me on a personal level, is compostable packaging. So there were several different brands that were displaying products at Cosmoprof where they're actually creating packaging that is designed to be completely compostable. Now, this is a very interesting step in sustainability, because we're not just talking about things that are biodegradable, right? Something that's biodegradable will eventually break down. There's not necessarily a timeline as to how long that takes. It may or may not need a specific type of or set of conditions to break down, but compostable packaging takes that to the next level. Compostable packaging can actually be put in your backyard, in your garden, in your compost pile, and break down in a specific set of time that doesn't really need such specific conditions to degrade. That was really cool to see. In particular, there is a brand called Caliray. They're out of California, and they just produced a biodegradable, so, you know, not quite compostable, but still very cool, palette for makeup. Now, not only is the palette refillable, so you can, if you run out of your pans of bronzer, let's say, or eyeshadow, you can actually buy new pans and just pop them in to continue to use the palette. But if you do decide you're done with the palette, it's made out of bamboo. It can actually be cracked apart and it will biodegrade. So that is something that is really, really cool to see. Another trend that I saw at Cosmoprof would be passive skincare technology. And this one was also really cool. So there are different companies that are creating technology products that are designed to improve your complexion or improve your already established routine without you having to do anything extra. And here's an example of this. There is a company that I saw that was exhibiting that has a water filter that you screw onto your bathroom sink faucet, and it filters out all the contaminants in your water to actually improve the quality of your skincare routine. And all you need to do is screw it onto your faucet. Removes things like chlorine and other types of irritants that can be found in tap water that may dull the skin or may just affect the absorption rate of your particular products that you use. You change nothing. All you do is you buy the filter, you put it on your faucet, and it should improve the quality of your skin over time, which is very, very cool. That was my very long-winded, you asked a loaded question, Amanda. There's a lot going on in the US right now.
Well, if that was a big question, my next question I think is even bigger, which is about everyone's favorite topic right now, the MOCRA regulations.
Oh boy, what do you want to know about MOCRA, Amanda?
Well, I want to know about, you know, whether you think that would impede the expansion of Asian brands into the US very greatly. I don't know, maybe you should start by giving us a little MOCRA overview for people who don't know.
Absolutely, I'd love to. This is one of my hottest topics of the year. So I will do what I can to try and make this as concise as possible because it's definitely a very multi-layered topic. There's a lot that goes into this. So for those of our listeners who are not familiar, MOCRA, or the Modernization of Cosmetic Regulations Act, is the first piece of U.S. regulatory legislation that has passed into law regarding cosmetics manufacturing in about 80 years. So this is a really big deal. It's a really big deal in our market. This is going to make a lot of changes. And so, you know, it's got some people a little worried, understandably a little concerned about what these changes are going to mean. MOCRA sets out several different standards, changes several different ways of how things have been done in the past, really focusing, I think the key takeaway to remember is that it really is focusing on making products more standardized and more regulated, which equals better safety and quality to the consumer product, right? In particular, one particular aspect of MOCRA that I think is really important to note is earlier this year, the FDA repealed the Voluntary Cosmetic Registration Program, or VCRP. Historically, the VCRP was a reporting system that manufacturers, packers, distributors of cosmetics products in the U.S., what they would do is they would launch a new product, and then they would list that product in this database, right? This is a voluntary program, and in March of this year, this program was repealed, and actually very recently, at the beginning of this month, the FDA announced that they are now working on implementing a new program. That program is going to be mandatory. There are certain guidelines that need to be followed in order to submit products, certain timelines that need to be followed, but it's now mandatory. And that's a big change, and that's a pretty big deal. Another aspect of MOCRA that I think speaks a little bit to your question, Amanda, about on how MOCRA may impact business relations on an international scale would be GMPs, or good manufacturing practices. So good manufacturing practices will come into full enforcement under MOCRA by the end of next year, December 29th of 2024. Earlier this year, I actually attended a listening session that was put on by the FDA where you could sign up, you could speak, you could just listen. It was a really interesting day of attendance. And there was a lot of talk about what is known as ISO 22716:2007. So what does all of that mean? ISO is the International Standard of Operation, and what that is setting is an international standard for good manufacturing practice compliance. Essentially, the standard exists to give guidelines for the production, control, storage, and shipment of cosmetics products. The reason that this is so important on an international scale is because this affects import and export. It's a really interesting topic. Again, it's very detailed, very multi-layered. But in particular, if we're speaking about international relations in terms of cosmetic business, there were several international commenters that actually showed up for the GMP listening session that I did earlier this year. In particular, there was a regulatory spokesperson from China who detailed that current Chinese GMP standards are actually stricter than the current standards in the U.S. On a U.S. side, this can actually slow down a U.S. company's attempt to enter into the Chinese market. And then reciprocally, this can actually make it difficult for Chinese companies to enter the U.S. market, right? There needs to be clarification. And so there was a lot of support in everyone adopting this ISO standard. It would make it standard internationally. So we're not dealing with different sets of standards anymore. It's just one particular standardized set of rules that everybody follows. Also, interestingly, if we're speaking about China, in 2020, China released the Cosmetic Supervision and Administration Regulation, the CSAR. That defined a cosmetic product. The FDA is actually working on trying to do the same because the definitions are not exactly the same. If everyone were to get on board and under MOCRA we were to adopt ISO 22716 as our GMP, then everybody would have a universal set of standards to follow. This would also solve a lot of issues with mislabeling of ingredients on import and export, which also can cause timeline issues. So I think that if we're looking at, again, on an international scale, GMPs are a really big place to look.
Well, that all sounds like another podcast, to be honest.
Girl, I could talk about this all day. I would say in terms of your question regarding Asian brands and the U.S. And MOCRA's new implementation, starts to come into effect at the end of this year. MOCRA is so big that it's not something that can be done in a day or even a year. There's actually a timeline for how they're rolling out the different pieces of MOCRA. Again, those pieces impact everything from record access, mandatory recall authority granted to the FDA, adverse event reporting, facility registration, product listings need to be listed and approved, safety substantiations, the appointment of responsible persons who are in charge of actually reporting. Like, there are people that are going to be appointed on the U.S. side that have to deal specifically with complying with MOCRA. So in a very succinct as I can way, yeah, I do think that there is going to be some impact. Like I was speaking to earlier, I think that the biggest impact is going to be on imports and exports. I really want to take a look and see. Right now, the FDA is currently actively working on establishing a proposal for the good manufacturing practices that I mentioned earlier. They're also launching a pilot program right now, which they're testing out, that is intended to replace the VCRP. Once those pieces are in place, and the FDA is required to have a proposal for GMPs in by the end of the year, it's going to take at least another year or so for that to be adopted. So I think that the key takeaway right now is nothing's happening today. There is going to be a certain period of waiting and seeing, but once the GMP is put into place, that's when Asian manufacturers that are looking to expand in the U.S. market are really going to need to have a good grasp and understanding of what the regulation states and what it means to comply with them. Hopefully, with the adoption of the ISO that I mentioned earlier, everything will come to a space of standardization, where we will be able to see everyone adhering to the same standards, which will certainly make things easier. But if for some reason the FDA and the US decide not to go with the international standard and instead choose to establish their own, then Asian manufacturers are going to need to not only understand what our standard is, but how it impacts theirs. Just because right now Chinese standards, again, for example, are more rigorous, doesn't mean that the U.S. may not flip and make it even more rigorous than the Chinese, in which case we'll then have to see that give and take of where the middle ground lies, where everyone is in compliance, because at the end of the day, the bottom line is complying with the standard.
Yes. So last word is just that, watch this space, right?
That's what I say. More to come. Watch this space. There's definitely going to be much more to come. I would say if you're particularly interested in this, do keep an eye on cosmetics design on all of our regions, because this is a really big... have I stressed that this is something really big happening in the U.S.? But this is something that is very big and will have big impact. And we are doing a lot of up-to-date reporting on it. We are trying to stay very close to this issue. We are trying to make sure that all of our updates are going across all of our regions. So if this is something that you're watching as a manufacturer, Definitely, you know, stay in tune with us, and we'll do our best to explain those timelines and what's happening as quickly as possible.
Yes, please visit Cosmetic Design and CosmeticDesignAsia.com as well, and subscribe to us. You know, registration is completely free, you know, and you will get all the information. This whole conversation is all based on our reporting. And that's a wrap. Thank you so much, Cassandra. Looking forward to having more conversations with you about the beauty industry.
Same. This was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to join you. And I look forward to doing this again soon.
This has been Beauty 4.0, Decoding the Business of Beauty, a podcast by Cosmetic Design, bringing you the inside stories on the innovations and innovators behind the beauty industry.